Thanks, folks. So I'm telling you, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some stuff that I've been doing for the last couple of years, mostly focused at the high luminosity LHC upgrade, but also thinking a little bit about what you can do with existing data sets and trigger streams in particular. So let's oh, wait a minute. Can I advance? I can advance. Okay. So you know that the LHC, of course, is an energy frontier machine. And it's working, as you know, very well. So the thing that you're seeing here on the right-hand side is some random like SUSY analysis I pulled out from a couple of years ago. So you see an event display here with about 13 jets. So it's increasingly complicated. So this is like, I believe, a RPV Glowino search of some sort. And so this analysis strategy here had something like 31 signal regions and then a factor of 4 more control regions in order to like estimate the backgrounds and all of these things. And so the main point of this is just to illustrate that these analyses have become extremely complicated. They're very often involve machine learning or neural nets. And they really have done a really good job in squeezing every bit of phase space, usable phase space out of these high energy signals. And there's little to do as a theorist to try to further optimize these things, except maybe with some machine learning techniques that people are working on. But on the other hand, the LHC is also an intensity frontier machine, as you all know. And so what you're seeing here is for a few existing for the LHC, Bell-2, and some optimistic rendering of the ILC at 500 GeV. Some estimate of the number of particles in each of these species that would be produced over the lifetime of the whole thing. And so you see in particular, the Higgs is both for Higgs bosons and Bs, or well, basically all of these particles. This will be the largest sample that any of us will probably see in our lifetimes. Unless we build like a 100 TeV collider very soon. And specifically, if you're interested in beyond the standard model physics, you're more interested in the Higgs and in the B for the simple reason that these are very, very narrow particles. And that means that you're much more sensitive to exotic decays, as in contrast to the top of the Z, which are fairly wide, relatively wide. So this is sort of roughly how this works. The number of exotic decays that you might see is proportional to the luminosity times the cross-section, of course, where I take here the B as an example. And then your exotic width in purple divided by the width of the meson or the particle in question. And so for Bs, you're winning twice in the sense that the cross-section is about half a millibar, which is absolutely huge, which is why you get 10 to the 14 of these things over the lifetime of the high lumi LHC. And famously, so it has a width of about 0.4 milliev, which means that you can be sensitive to very, very small exotic decays in principle. Now, so of course, this is to be understood as something that's complementary, not replacing these searches at Bell-2, for instance, because we have severe background and trigger challenges at the LHC. So it's not clear that in all channels we will be able to use this full data set that we have over here. But if you have signals which are particularly low rate and for which you can both online and offline have relatively low backgrounds, you can try to leverage this enormous particle yield and do better than Bell-2 or especially the ILC when we're talking about Higgs decays. So more generally, this is sort of in my mind. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick question. People also discuss kaon production for LHCb. Do you know how many kaons are
Oh, how many
produced?
kaons that the LHCb produces? Well, I don't know top of my head, but we can estimate, right? So the cross-section, inclusive cross-section is about 50 millibar or so. And so they will have, are you going to ask me to do the math in my head? So they're going to have about, let's say, 100 inverse femtobarn by the end of the run. So that's 10 to the.
That's, I guess, will be more than these, is what you're
Oh
saying.
yeah, for sure. Yeah. So the they'll you'll have, I think, at LHCb something like order 10 to the 17. Yeah, you'll have 10 to the 17, 10 to the 18 collisions, right? Each collision will have a handful of kaons for sure. So you'll have many orders of magnitude more kaons. Now, kaons are more challenging to reconstruct for various reasons in the sense that, well, some of them are living very long, right? So the K-long and the K-plus are two tuples, so like they're basically stable particles. And the K-short, the K is usually two tracks, two pions, and goes semi-leptonically, right? It goes...
But is anyone looking into that?
Neutrino usually.
Okay. But is anyone looking into these K-shorts? I'm just curious because, you know, B-physics...
What I was getting at is like kaons are experimentally much more challenging, and so the best way to look for kaonic case, as Daniel can tell you, is in fixed target experiments like NA62 or NA64, those kind of things, or CODO, because those are really designed to make a collimated beam of these things, and you can get a massive yield of those because you're dumping the whole proton beam rather than doing.
I understand. Yeah, I was just curious.
It's something that you can't really do for Bs as easily. Yeah. But yes, for kaons, the argument is even stronger in the sense that the width is even smaller, right? And the cross section can be even larger. Though the LHC is not quite the right machine for that. There you really benefit from a fixed target experiment.
Sure. Thanks.
Yeah, so a bit more generally, I think this is sort of where stuff is heading in the LHC. So the sort of first two pillars are probably familiar to you. We're going to do, of course, precision measurements, which are supported by precision calculations on the theory front. And for the complicated hadronic final states, is machine learning as a field is taking off quite rapidly, and they're making very good progress there. But I think something that there is more room for progress, which hasn't really been studied so much, especially on the theory side, is to look for softer final states. With low PT. And so here we look at new trigger strategies, which I'll explain in a second. Things like data scouting or maybe special data taking runs at lower luminosity or in heavy ion collisions and so on. And so this is the part that I've been interested in the last few years. So traditionally you might think like, okay, why would you as a theorist bother with triggers in the sense that that's just something experiments decide. You look up in the paper, see what the thresholds are. You just roll with it. However, things have evolved quite a bit since the early days of the LHC in the sense that these triggers are very sophisticated now. There are hundreds and hundreds of them. And you can trigger on various combinations of various particles and do fairly sophisticated things in the online selection. And so that means that if we have particular suggestions, they can implement those, in particular in the online, in the high level trigger. So specifically, most analyses now more and more have basically their own trigger stream. So they design a specific trigger for a specific analysis more often these days, rather than a sort of limited table they used to have. But at the same time, resources are very limited, and it goes both for bandwidth, like the amount of things that you can try to record, as well as folks on the experiment who can actually go and implement those triggers, because it's a very time-consuming and labor-intensive process to implement and validate new trigger strategies. And so I think we can play two roles as theorists. One is to, of course, provide theory priors in terms of like helping them decide how to prioritize their limited resources. But also, as we alluded to earlier, think about complementarity to make sure that other experiments that also live on the intensity frontier, that we don't spend too much resources on things that are going to be covered elsewhere. And so this is something that I think we can contribute as theorists. And so there's a sense of urgency, of course, because the trigger is only useful if you implement it before you take data. And the phase two upgrade designs are being finalized now. And so if we want to make suggestions on things that should change, we shouldn't wait for 5 years, because then everything will be frozen. So first talk a little bit about the theory priors. So I've been mostly interested in long-lived particles, though not exclusively, as we'll see at the end of the talk. And the first reason is very pragmatic, in the sense that if I'm lowering my trigger thresholds, clearly my backgrounds are going to go up. And so I'd like ideally a new handle to reject backgrounds. And having a particle that decays with a macroscopic displacement is, of course, a very good handle to reject standard model backgrounds and can give you very nice limits. It's the second, maybe more gratifying reason in some ways, is that there's also a theory prior that once you go for light particles that are of the order of, you know, let's say GV, maybe 10 GV or so on, and they live in some sort of dark sector, they have to typically decay through some higher dimensional operator or through one of the minimal portals that we're all familiar with. And in those scenarios, you tend to find frequently that they tend to be automatically long-lived. And we'll see a few examples of those. This is also something that's true in the standard model. So what you're seeing here is a plot made by Brian a number of years ago that's been going around the community a lot. The mass versus lifetime of LSTM model particles. And you see there's a clear trend. The lighter you go, the more long-lived you become. For off, you have to decay to an off-shell W. And there's a wide range of lifetimes, of course, that you can probe. The same is true in a variety of beyond the standard model, extensions of the standard model. And so here's the simplest example, perhaps, right? So if I have this is the simplest extension of the standard model I can think of. It's a single real degree of freedom. And if I couple it to the Higgs with this cubic coupling, after I set the Higgs to its vacuum expectation value, this thing mixes with the Higgs, it picks up an effective Yukawa coupling to all the standard model fermions proportional to the standard model Yukawas, but suppressed by this mixing angle sine theta over here, which is always taken to be small. And so if this thing is smaller than the mass of the B minus the kaon, the most dominant production mode of this thing is going to be through this B penguin on the right-hand side here, something that's been known since the 80s. And so you see it couples to this virtual top quark in the penguin proportional to the top quark, top Yukawa. And the branching ratio is shown on the left. It's a factor of 6 roughly times sine theta squared. And you might wonder, like, okay, why is this prefactor 6 so large? Because, you know, it's a two-body decay, but it's suppressed by a loop. It's suppressed by you know, some powers of G Fermi. The reason is, of course, that we talked about earlier, that the width of the B is extremely small. And so that compensates for the suppression factor. So you get this order one number up front. So you can get very large rates, even for very small mixing angles. The decay follows largely that of the standard model Higgs. And so here I plotted the full mass range up to 100 GeV. But for B decays, of course, we're interested in the sort of more low mass regime over here. So there's not too much to say about that you don't already know, except that one has to be mindful in this sort of GeV-ish regime, the uncertainties are very large. And many of these branching ratios are not known very precisely. The reason now, this is the total width, and so the distinct tends to decay somewhat, tends to be somewhat long lived, even for relatively moderate mixing angles. So if I have a mixing angle of 10 to the minus 3 in this regime over here, I'm going to be already at centimeters displacement. The reason for that, maybe if I go back just, sorry about this, to this slide over here, is that you always tend to decay to one of the lower generation Yukawa couplings. So there is a parametric suppression of the width of this new scalar phi compared to its production mode that goes to the top Yukawa. So this branching rate, this width is rather challenging to compute. So it was computed or last updated in a significant way by Martin Winkler in 2018, where he in particular obtained this piece on the left-hand side here, using a combination of chiral perturbation theory and then this analytic continuation dispersion techniques. And the thing on the right is a perturbative calculation, while in the middle you have to interpolate. And so we made a very minor update to his result at some point because he had not included the analog corrections at the in the perturbative regime, which are of course known from the old days, from when people were doing Higgs physics to high precision. And so we just updated this result. And so you get a slightly different curve over here with the difference here in the bottom. But really the bulk of the calculation was done by Martin in 2018.
The largest difference is in the interpolation region. And why is that?
Right. Oh, that's just because the main difference over here is, I believe the next leading order correction to the gluon width. Is important in this region below the charm. And that leaks into the interpolation in the sense that the interpolation region is anchored on these two endpoints in some way. So if you change the, you know, where you start interpolating, I mean, the interpolation is really just a polynomial. I mean, it's really just drawing a, you know, you estimate how it should scale with phase space, and then you just connect the, you just connect the two calculations. You really don't have a much better handle in this regime. Mm-hmm. So the uncertainties here are fairly large. And this is due to the fact that this is different over here. To the analog correction, to the, in particular to the phi to glue glue width, which at leading order is not a very good approximation.
Right.
And even at analog, it's questionable, but it's at least a bit better.
Thanks.
Yeah, so then, but that's sort of like a small detour in this model, which has been very well known since the 80s, so I don't have too much to add to that. So what I've been trying to do is I always tend to work with experimentalists for whatever I do on this front. And so what we try to do is experimentalists know what's feasible. Ideally, as theorists, we think that we know what might be desirable, and we try to do the stuff that you know, is in the overlap over here. So in practice, of course, it more looks like this rather than a blackboard. So you end up doing quite a bit of Monte Carlo processing. So those are the two things that I will talk about today. So I'll mostly be talking about dedicated triggers for displaced vertices. So this is some ideas that I worked out with Yuri Gerstein to see if there are new things that we could do with the CMS detector during the phase two upgrade using the new technology that they're implementing now. And then there is this new set of analyses that are coming out from specifically CMS, but also Atlas using data scouting techniques. And so we're also hoping to add something to that, but that's sort of more for a near-term strategy. So this is work in progress that we'll hopefully talk a little bit about at the end of the talk.
Can I ask you something very quickly? So the production, you said the main production diagram is just the decay of the B, right?
Yeah.
What about, so you also said yourself that kaons are towards some magnitude more abundant. What about the case of the kaons once the guy is light enough, or yeah, other like ETAs?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So then that will dominate. However, in that mass regime, you're better off. I think the strongest constraints come from LSMD at this moment. There's also the old charm constraint.
Okay. Okay. You're just not going to compete with those.
Yeah, factors. No, I think you're better off. It would be interesting, yeah, I suppose it would be interesting to see if that can be updated for one of the more modern beam dump experiments like NA62 or CODO. I haven't looked into that. But I think the strongest constraint on that comes from LSMD, which was something that was done a few years ago by the Victoria group, I think.
But then just to be clear, what you're going to aim for is for the case of the B with a displaced the object coming from the singlet. That's what you're going to aim for.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm not going to be too worried about kaons because I think that there's other experiments that are better at that.
I think at that point it's too long lived. And then
yeah, okay.
Probably the best place is the new me kaon decays at rest that people have started looking at already. So,
but even if it's long lived, like if it's very long lived, you will still have a signal that just scales with the length of the detector, which is whatever a few meters in the tracker.
Right. I mean, I'm inclined to think. I mean, this is a discussion we can have afterwards. But I'm inclined to think that you're always for long lived decays, you're always better to have a kaon beam decaying in flight rather than stopping it. Because otherwise, you're also putting the you want also to give a bit of a boost to the singlet, so that if it's somewhat short lived, that you can still resolve its displacement. But I guess that depends a bit on the parameter space. It's something we can discuss.
Okay.
I don't have much to say about that now. Okay, but so we're going to talk a little bit about this, and then at the end, I'll get a bit to data scouting, which is some work in progress. Just sort of a reminder for those of you who don't think about triggers very frequently, but this is sort of how Atlas and CMS work. So beams are collided at a frequency of 40 megahertz in the interaction point. And then there is a level one hardware trigger. So that's literally on the detector itself. There's a bunch of chips that decide whether or not an event will be pulled up to the surface through fiber optic cables and then fit into a data farm that sits above the experimental cavern. And so this is called a level one trigger. So this reduces the rate down from 40 megahertz to about 10 kilohertz. And so this is a trigger that once you build the experiment, it's very difficult to update. Then this this data farm over here reconstructs the full event more or less. It's called a high level trigger. And this brings down the total rate from 100 kilohertz to down to 1 kilohertz. And so this is something that you can dynamically update by putting in new algorithms as the experiment is running, essentially. So these are just, I think you folks all know this. So only a very small fraction of the collisions get recorded. And of course, this is completely critical for these things to work. Otherwise, we would just never be able to store or read out all this data. The main thing that is relevant for what I want to say is that at the moment, there's no tracking happening at level one because the tracker is a very complicated instrument that has many, many channels. And there's just no computing power at the level one trigger to actually read out all these channels and reconstruct these tracks. So track reconstruction happens at the HLT trigger. So whatever signal that you have that relies on tracks, you have to figure out some other way to get it out of the level one trigger. So specifically, as far as CMS is concerned, this is a slice of CMS, you know, tracker, Kahlo, muon system as usual. But that means that the level one trigger only sees this detector. So it doesn't really know that it has a tracker. And so if I have a displaced vertex that's relatively soft, so it's the decay products point relatively well to the interaction point. The calorimeters can't really tell the difference, and you would throw out this very promising the signal that would be very spectacular if you had it on tape. It would be thrown out by the existing triggers. Now, what Atlas and CMS are doing, they're upgrading their trigger systems. And the reason for that is has nothing to do with long-lived particles, but it has to do with pileup in the sense that this is a typical collision on the left, currently about 25 pileup events, and they'll go to something like 250 at the Hirumi, which is the thing on the right. And so unless you upgrade your detectors, you know, everything, all your trigger resolutions, your triggers in particular will really be swamped and go to hell, especially the MET trigger would be become completely useless. You would have to raise the threshold to like 500 GeV or some if you can't update this. And so the two main things they're gonna do is they're gonna make sure they have more bandwidth so they can actually read out more events. So that's just sort of the brute force approach to upgrading the experiment. But they're also thinking about having new capabilities directly at the level one trigger to make more informed decisions. And so that the level one trigger will be able to decide in a better way which events to keep and which events to throw out. And this is especially important for the MET resolution in particular. And so we're gonna see if we can try to leverage this. But first let's take a look at how they're actually hoping to achieve this. So this is the layout of the phase two tracker as it will look like for CMS after the upgrade. And there's a few differences with the current tracker in particular. You see that now there is this region up to eta of 4, while currently the tracker stops roughly around 2.4. So they have more resolution in the forward. They have track reconstruction also in the forward region. But more importantly for what I want to talk about is the trigger system. And so the trigger will still not be able to read out these first four pixel layers. So these are pixel detectors, while the blue and the red are strip detectors. Because the occupancy is too high, they just can't handle that amount of data. But they're doing something super clever and super interesting with these strip detectors, and that's the following. So each of these layers over here is secretly a double layer. So there are two layers of tracking that are separated by a few millimeters of each other, but crucially, they're connected to the same chip. So that means that these couple of pixels here are connected to the same chip. So if a track passes through, it can immediately measure the pitch between these two, the angle between these two layers in some ways. And without doing reconstructing a track, it can roughly estimate the PT of this, what they call a stub, by just computing this angle, because they, of course, know the magnetic field. So in other words, a track with a PT higher than 2 GeV will look something like this. With a track with a softer PT, like less than 2 GeV, will look a little bit more like this, and will get discarded over here. And so then they write out only the stops that satisfy this 2 GeV criterion. And so those are much lower. That's a much lower amount than if you were to write out all of them. And they are able to reconstruct fit tracks, fit a helix through these things at high enough rate at the level one trigger. And then that way they can make more informed decisions of what to pull into the high level trigger. And so we're going to see if we can try to leverage this thing for displaced particles as well. So this thing is designed for prompt tracks, or tracks that are pointing back to an interaction point. However, Yuri realized that it would actually also be able to perhaps reconstruct displaced tracks. And so this is a simulation that was done with CMS. So this is the PT of a track, and this D0 object here is the impact parameter of the track in the transverse plane. So it's the shortest distance to the beam line of the helix. The negative sign is just, there are some conventions there. So you can really just think of the absolute value of this if you want. It looks very symmetric. And so what they found is that even with impact parameter of a few centimeters, at least in principle, you would be able to reconstruct these displaced tracks. Now that is a statement about the geometric acceptance of this type of strategy. It would involve an additional investment in terms of computing power to actually carry out this reconstruction, because you're adding one parameter to the fit. Normally you would restrict the track to be pointing to the beam line. Well, if you're relaxing that, it gets computationally more intensive. So they did have to invest in additional computing. But at least in principle, this is something they could do if the physics case is good enough. And so that's what we're going to try to do, is we're going to try to show that the physics case for this type of approach is really nice, and they should try to do it.
Sorry, but just to be clear, so they will be able to trigger on the track, and the resolution of so what's the resolution that they're going to have in the vertex?
We'll get to that. So at the moment, you know, the answer is that they need to study that. So they don't have a plan on triggering displaced vertices. Although now I think there's something about this in the TDR, so they started working on it. The original plan is to just do prompt tracks, but what they're showing over here is just if you just inject tracks, individual tracks, into their simulation, you can actually reconstruct them, provided that you have the computing power to carry out the calculation at the trigger level.
So
that is a statement about this geometric acceptance over here, because this is completely baked in. You can't change this, right? And so the more displaced your track is, the more likely it is to go at a wide angle, and the more likely it is to fall into this category, even if the PT was high. So that's what this plot is simulating.
I see. And this idea will only work, of course, when you have these double layers of thingies, these double, what's the name that you, these double strips, right?
Yeah.
So it would be only in the first like 10 centimeters. Okay.
Sorry, so no, so these six layers all have these double strips.
Oh, they all have them. Okay.
Yeah, they all have them. Not, I just highlighted one of them, but all of them have this, right?
Okay.
You can only do this. Yeah, for the inner layers, you don't have any information at all. So as far as we're concerned, they don't exist. And so here, if the acceptance is high enough, you might be able to reconstruct this. It's very non-trivial to see just by eye, and so this is why we have to do simulation. We have to simulate those tracks, as I'll show. See how they go through the layers, see what the angle is, check if they pass the cut, and then fit a new track to it, which is what we end up doing.
Okay.
And so they did some preliminary thing with the muon gun. So this is not a real signal. This is just, they just fire some particles at it and say, oh, okay, well, we should be able to do this sort of thing. Now, so this is basically what I was telling Daniel. And so let me just put all the, actually, sorry, let me go from the beginning. So this is a quadrant of the CMS detector, as it will look like, with these same layers as before. So the first thing that we have to do is, let's say that we have a decay over here. It goes to two muons. So the muon goes out. So we propagate it through the magnetic field. And we check where it intersects with each of these layers. Now, whenever it intersects a layer, it goes through some piece of material. So it can undergo multiple scattering. So its momentum gets slightly corrected in a random way, because it's bumping against particles in the detector. And so this we have to model. So we throw some random numbers and we sort of correct this track so that it wiggles a little bit. Then what you do is you check for each of these layers, is this criteria that we saw a few slides earlier on the pitch, is it satisfied? And if so, we record this as a hit. And so in this example, I assumed that all of these six guys were recorded as a hit. And then finally, we fit the helix through this thing, just a smooth track. And if you do this twice, for instance, for a Daimyon final state, you can compute the intersection of these two tracks, or at least the point of closest approach, and you can try to reconstruct the vertex. And so this is our sort of simplified software simulation that we would do to calculate the signal efficiency for this sort of thing.
Can I ask a quick thing? Sorry. Yeah. In the first image, you were showing the propagation of the track, and it seemed that at each step, at each interaction with the one layer, it was like gaining some energy in the and going more towards the external part and not losing some energy. Yeah. Was it just a coincidence, or?
I mean, I just made them wiggle a little bit because of the multiple scattering. I didn't think about whether or not they're gaining or losing energy. Sorry. I mean, of course, they would be losing energy in reality. So maybe you're saying it should have all bended in the other way. Yeah, that's possible. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Just understand if I was missing something. Yeah. Fine.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So there are kinks there and like little kinks. And that's just because it's traveling through the detector material, which is something that you have to model when you're trying to reconstruct the vertex, because it degrades the vertexing resolution.
Yeah.
And so it's actually very important. So I don't know if I have a plot, but like if you don't do this, you have a too optimistic answer for the vertex resolution.
Okay, thanks.
But I guess most of your events are going to be very collimated for this type of soft event that you're interested in, right? So I'm just asking, is the beginning of the two tracks, if it's degenerate, does it, you know, it would be harder for you to reconstruct two tracks from that and to tell where the interaction point was?
Well, this is why we do simulation, right? But I don't agree that they're very collimated because they're very soft, right? So the PT threshold on these muons is going to be very small. So that means that even for relatively, and the boost of the scalar is not going to be very large. It's only order one. So these opening angles are not tiny at all. This is the difference with the intuition. With if you do a normal dimuon trigger, a light particle, and if I have to trigger on a 45 GV muon, then they have to be super collimated. But here I'll be able to get away with a 4.5 GV trigger threshold.
Okay. You're right.
And then, and that's the key innovation, because otherwise you're right. Like if you have to use the regular triggers, you pay rate, but also acceptance because they start overlapping.
Mm-hmm.
No, very good. Okay, so here is just, this is just a validation plot. We're just plotting what we recover for the efficiency compared to the CMS plot that I showed earlier. And it's in decent agreement. We are a little bit more pessimistic than CMS at the high energy, the high displacement tail, but that's conservative, basically. Now, I have to introduce a little bit of variables here, just so that we're on the same page about what we're actually plotting. So this is my Daimyon vertex. Now I'm looking in the XY plane. These three layers are some just to indicate some rough tracking layers. They're just cartoon here. So if I extend the helix of this thing, the D0 parameter is the impact parameter in the transverse plane. So it's this distance of closest approach of the track itself. LXY is always the distance of the vertex to the interaction, to the beam line, again, in the transverse plane. And this D5 is if I reconstruct the trajectory of the motor particle based on the PT, on the momenta of these two muons, I can calculate the impact parameter of the motor particle, and so that we're going to call d phi, as in the impact parameter of the hypothetical particle phi. And then finally, these vertices are never perfect. So even this is in the z direction and in the radial direction, you just pick an angular slice. So the tracks never fully completely overlap. And this delta z is the distance of closest approach between the two tracks at the location of the of your estimate of where the vertex should be, and this is an estimate of how good of a vertex, how high quality the vertex actually is. So you're going to cut on this to make sure that you have high quality vertices. The signal is again this thing that we talked about before, and by now you've guessed that I'm going to make this thing decay to muons. And so the main backgrounds that I worry about in particular are fake vertices, because there's a large number of fake tracks that are being reconstructed by this sort of thing, and they might randomly intersect and provide you with a fake vertex. And if that happens too frequently, your trigger is not viable. You just get swamped. There are kaons and there are b-mesons. And so I remind you that here we're interested in building a trigger that can get us from level one to high HLT. And so we're not interested in getting a background-free scenario, but we're interested in putting the most minimal cuts that get down the rate with order or about four orders of magnitude so that we have enough bandwidth in order to write this thing to tape. That's the goal. And then offline, you can try to put more cuts to improve signal over background further. So let's go through these two backgrounds individually. So the fakes are really a disaster. So you have, on average, as we know from the CMS simulations, about 30 fake tracks for each event. So let's say that 15 of these are positive tracks, 15 of these are negative tracks. So that's a priori, before you do anything, you have per event have 225 fake vertices in each event. Now, these will have a distribution in this delta Z. They're usually not very, the vertex is very shitty usually. They don't really intersect in the Z plane. And so you get this sort of flat background distribution. Well, the signal, of course, is a true vertex, so it peaks at very low delta Z. So we can cut here and we can get about two orders of magnitude suppression from cutting on this thing. The second thing that happens is if we look at the impact parameter, we reconstruct the vertex, and then you look at the impact parameter of the mother particle with the beamline, the signal is going to point back to the beamline fairly well because the beam meson lifetime is relatively short. It's only a few millimeters. Well, even if I reconstruct the vertex with a fake track, chances are it's just going to point in some random direction. It has no real reason to point back approximately to the beamline. And so if we also cut on this, we get another two orders of magnitude suppression. So we recovered from this disaster. We got two orders of magnitude. So now we're down from 40 megahertz to something like 400 kilohertz or so.
And how reliable are these background estimates or fake, I guess, EMSP?
This is an estimate of a benchmark. This is something that you can dial. The experimentalist can dial in the sense that the amount of fakes that you get depends on how stringent your track quality requirements are, like how good of a fit you want for each of these tracks, right? Okay. So if you find that you have too many, you might tighten it. You will lose some signal acceptance,
right?
But you can bring down these backgrounds. So roughly, the system has, it can buffer about 150 to 200 tracks per event. And so the assumption here is that no more than 25% of those tracks should be fake tracks, because otherwise you're just wasting too much bandwidth. So these are to be taken as sort of like order one estimates in some ways, but they're subject to how they choose the algorithms, how they choose the parameters in the algorithm. So they can dial this to some degree.
I see, but I guess what I'm trying to understand is, once you fix the parameters that for your signal, whatever you are defining as a signal, mm-hmm. How much do you trust these background estimates? How are they calculated? Yeah, so the tracker is not yet implemented, so I guess they write down a GAN package or something.
So there is a GAN simulation of this, which is where this is coming from. So the answer is that the right way to think about it is that the uncertainty, while you're right, it's like pretty sizable. It's actually really uncertainty on the signal efficiency rather than on the background. Because suppose that this background is too large, right? They have handles to tighten the criteria. For instance, they might cut harder on the tracking, on the impact parameter and so on, right? Yeah. To reduce those backgrounds at the expense of some signal efficiency, right? But they are, of course, confident that this is not going to ruin their whole system because, that is clear. Because you can always tighten the requirements to reduce this background further at the expense of some signal acceptance.
And they
estimating how much that works is impossible as a theorist.
I see. So that, and by they you mean Yuri and like what are students that Yuri put in writing this thing or okay, good.
Well, the CMS collaboration as a whole, it's not just Yuri, of course, but oh, it's one of the people who's leading this, yeah.
Okay, so they actually have a group within CMS doing this stuff.
Yes. Yeah, no, there's groups working on these triggers, of course. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And the same for the background estimate on the right. It's done the same way.
The background estimate is just that's actually not so difficult because we know again from CMS simulation what the probability distribution is of the background estimate in the tracking parameters. It's basically just a uniform flat distribution. So we just throw random fake tracks in our simulation, and then we do the reconstruction using the whole pipeline that I laid out earlier.
Okay.
But so the normalization of this thing, we're pretty sure that the distribution of this is pretty much clear. I mean, it should be flat, right? I mean, it's just the normalization of this thing is taken from the CMS simulation, and there is some sizable uncertainty on that, but not to the extent that it would ruin their trigger.
Okay.
So this helps already quite a bit. We're not quite there yet. So here is. Here are the rates at the moment that we have just from putting those two cuts on it using three different PT cuts, so 3GV, 4GV, and 5 and 3GV. And so you have still a kilohertz worth of fakes using this with the cuts that I had before. Plus, there is also about a kilohertz worth of K shorts decaying to pi plus, pi minus. Now, the way we're going to get rid of the remaining rate down to, we have to get roughly down to 1 kilohertz in order to make this thing viable, is to require that these tracks are actually muons and connect these tracks to the muon chamber, which is something they think they can do. And so here you're limited by the probability of a pion punching through the calorimeter and faking a muon in the muon system. And so we have to assume here that this is less than 5% probability for each track. Which was an assumption at the time when we wrote this paper, but in the meanwhile, this has been validated by CMS internally. So this looks like this works. And they think they can actually wire the electronics such that they can connect the muon chamber to the tracker in a way to do this at a level one trigger.
And can you, like, isn't there going to be a timing layer right on in between the tracker and the ecals or something, can you use timing in some way?
Like
some geometrical triangle or something differently from
No, timing only works if the environment, this is what Zen has been excited about. So it only works if the invariant mass of the particle is relatively high.
Okay.
Because you need it to be fairly slow.
You need it to be slow. Yeah, but here
the triangle needs to be sufficiently large so that you have like a sufficiently large area. But for these soft signals, this is not enough.
Oh, it's not enough. Okay.
Even if you did that, there's still challenges in the sense that my understanding is that reading out the timing layer at level one is not something they intended to do, and is very difficult because that thing also has very high rate. And so, some R&D is needed there as well to see if that can be done. And you really need to provide them with some ideas about other things to cut on. If you just ask, okay, can you read out the timing layer for every event you record? I mean, this just doesn't work. So you have to do something there as well.
But the timing resolution, is it nanoseconds or microseconds?
I think like hardware, the hardware they were designing for it to be picosecond.
Yeah, it's more like picosecond. Right,
it was insanely fast.
Yes, it's very fast. I mean, the time between two collisions at the LHC is 25 nanoseconds. So it has to be substantially smaller than a nanosecond. Mm. Otherwise, it's not useful.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember somebody told me they were designing these new whatever silicon thingies that their rise time is super incredibly faster than everything else.
This stuff is very fancy. Yeah, it's these are really one of the fastest detectors known at the moment, I think. Yeah. But okay, so that we cannot use, the resolution is not good enough for these things. You would need much better resolution if you were to try to use this. And it basically, you would get swamped by background because there's not a huge difference between the signal and background when it comes to timing for these guys. Anyway, so using muons as a selection criteria, we think these things can be brought down to roughly kilohertz regime which is sort of the level at which you can put it in the trigger without anyone really noticing and nobody complaining that you're eating up too much bandwidth. B mesons have actual muons in them in their decay. You have a double atomic decay. You have a displaced B meson that makes two muons, even in the standard model. Now, these things are very easily removed by just cutting a little bit on the displacement of the vertex, just because B mesons are relatively short-lived. They only have a lifetime of a few millimeters. And so these set of cuts are more than sufficient to bring down the rate to much less than a kilohertz for B mesons. So this is the yield that we estimate for these three different benchmarks for the trigger thresholds. So this is normalized by the product of the branching ratios. This is the number of particles as a function of the lifetime of the scalar phi that you would record during the lifetime of the high Lumi LHC. And so you see the green line is the current LHCb dimuon trigger. And so they would, of course, do much better at very low displacements because we have to put in this cut on the displacement to get rid of B mesons, which they can just reconstruct. That's why the reach falls off over here. But in this regime, there's a sizable chance that CMS would at least be competitive with LHCb when it comes to collecting the number of particles they can collect. And it's much, much better to like a very optimistic, this is a very optimistic dimuon trigger with 10 GeV for each muon. In reality, it's more like 25, but this is sort of assuming that more improvements are possible. You're seeing that you're doing much better by using something like this. The reason is really that retraining PT threshold for actually reconstructing a displaced vertex is really the idea. Okay. So then the next thing that we set out doing is to make a little bit of an estimate. Like now, suppose you reconstruct, you can implement this. So CMS is looking into this, and you can actually collect these events. How well would you actually do on a model like with an offline analysis, assuming that you could record these events? And to understand that, I want to briefly explain how LHCb is currently doing this. So they're reconstructing an exclusive decay chain. So for instance, B plus going to K plus and phi, and they reconstruct the two displaced vertices, the one from the B and then the one from the muons. And they reconstruct the kaon, and they require that all of these things add up to the B mass and so on. So it's a fully reconstructed decay chain. And so this is sort of the reach they can get with this thing. In invariant mass of the muon, so you see this is the prompt region, and they have very little background for the red, which is the sort of high lifetime bin that they have. They've been in time rather than displacement, but it's essentially the same thing. And so this is their plot, which is apparently made in Microsoft Paint, but you sort of get the idea like this is the region that's excluded with fairly small mixing angles down to 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. And they can do very well in the prompt regime because they have this fully reconstructed decay chain. But this reconstructing this decay chain is not free. It means that their signal efficiency is fairly low. It's only like 10 to the minus 3 or so, because there are various inefficiencies towards reconstructing all these particles, reconstructing all these vertices and so on, and it adds up. Now for CMS, what you wanna do is you don't wanna actually reconstruct, you have higher PT thresholds, but you have a cylindrical detector. So you're much better at seeing large displacements than LHCb is, because LHCb is really optimized to see millimeter sized displacements. As soon as you go to a few centimeters, their signal efficiency is pretty poor. Well, that's not true for CMS. So what CMS is, instead of reconstructing the whole event, the decay chain, they should only reconstruct the displaced vertex and perform an inclusive search, just looking just at the dimuon search. And so they get a better signal efficiency that way. And they can reject backgrounds by cutting a little bit harder on the displacement, which LHCb is unable to do because their signal efficiency would suffer too much just because of the geometry of the detector. So this is something that I did with Jared last year. So we simulated, we tried to estimate this, how well they would do. So we simulated this background. So this is, for example, this B decay background. It's a double leptonic background. And so you construct a dimuon invariant mass. We put some basic cuts on this thing. And eventually you can get down to, with some relatively minimal cuts, down to something that's the order of a few events for the whole high Lumi run. I have some backup slides for this if anyone's interested. I don't want to dwell on this too long. And so this is the sort of reach that we think we can potentially get with this type of thing. This is CMS. This is a generous extrapolation of LHCb. CMS is also generous in the sense that we're only modeling physics backgrounds. So there are various junk backgrounds from, you know, detector effects and so on, which we can't really model. So this is also, both of these curves are optimistic in the sense that this here, there are some systematic backgrounds neglected. And here we are taking the absolute most optimistic rescaling of LHCb, assuming that they remain background free with unchanged signal efficiency throughout the whole high Lumi run. So both of these have some uncertainties on it from the
extrapolation. I don't understand that. So the in that uncertainty, in that estimate, you only include the backgrounds from the bees, but you don't include fake tracks?
For CMS, yeah. So for fake tracks are very important at the trigger level because you have very incomplete information and your track fit is not, your fit is not very good.
Yeah.
Especially because you don't have the inner layers of the tracker. But once you have written the event to tape, the fake tracks and the fake vertices are much more easily to reject. You can basically get rid of all of them because you can do a more precise track fitting. You have additional layers in the inner detector and you have more time to run a more sophisticated algorithm in particular and calibrate things more carefully. So that's the main reason why there are so many fakes at the trigger level, because you have only 10 microseconds to do everything. So you have to cut some corners here and there. Now there might still be some.
So
estimating how many of those there are is challenging. I think Zen tried this for some other model, but I don't want to.
That's what I'm getting to. I mean, I believe that after you do offline stuff, you will reduce that. But numerically, how are you so sure that that's updating, for instance, to the B backgrounds?
I am not sure. No, that's why I'm putting this this caveat.
I see. Yeah. And could it be that then once we include fake trucks I guess you don't have an idea on how much would that line move after
you. No, you don't. Well, look, it's a log plot, right? So if I have, unless I have millions of these, of course, then things will be bad. Now we already have an existing detector. And existing experiments, right? And they reconstruct not exactly this type of signal, but things similar. And fake backgrounds are never really an issue or never really the dominant background compared to like physics backgrounds.
Okay,
what could be an issue are like detector effects, like you might have, for instance, a photon hitting a piece of the tracker and creating, instead of converting to a mu plus mu minus pair, might maybe it occasionally converts to a mu plus mu minus pair.
Yeah.
And usually you get rid of these by vertexing and vetoing layers in the tracker. But maybe that somehow goes wrong. And maybe, you see what I'm saying? Like those kind of like very leading epsilon squared effects you could have. But it's not feasible to simulate these from first principles without having access to CMS simulation. So that's why I'm saying these are our best estimates, the best we think we can do. And I don't know, I don't want to claim here that CMS will definitely do better than LHCb, but I think we're confident enough to say that they should be competitive if they end up carrying.
Okay. At level one, the fake trucks, what's their ratio to just events coming from bees?
It depends on your cards.
I guess they are significantly more.
I mean, if you don't cut on anything, you have basically, you only cut on vertex quality, right? You have about one fake track per event, one fake vertex per event. If you only cut on the vertex quality, non-pointing or muons or anything else. So like basically you should think of at the trigger level, every event will have a somewhat shitty, but a somewhat reasonable displaced vertex in it. From two fakes randomly.
Okay, and then for a proper analysis, so imagine that this thing goes through and then the trigger is implemented. So then the steps forward, I guess, to do a full analysis and actually setting limits would be to perform the simulations of these backgrounds, like to utmost detail. Yes.
Well, I'll show you on the next slide. You can actually measure them because they already have.
Oh, they have measured them.
In the current detector, but you know, you don't, I'll show you in a second.
Okay, yes, cool.
So hold that thought.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so anyway, so you know, I should have said in the beginning of the talk, anything that I'm saying here, you know, is, you know, we do the best we can, but it's very difficult to make strong claims about detectors that don't yet exist, right? And so I think that should be, this is sort of meant as a motivation for experimentalists to look into, but that doesn't mean, especially on the right-hand side, this is when I map this onto the scalar model, I don't want to necessarily claim that I know for sure that CMS will beat Bell 2. I mean, I think that it could be competitive, but you know, it depends on many things, both on the Bell 2 side as well on the CMS side. And but the gain of reach seems interesting enough that it's worth looking into.
And the timeline for Phaser 2 is similar. What's
yes, I mean it's the same luminosity. Yes, so Phaser 2 is. Yeah, it's not yet approved, as you know, and it's a large, it's not a cheap experiment anymore, right? I mean, Phaser 1 is very cheap, but Phaser 2 is substantial. I mean, I think it might happen, but
and Phaser 1 is not here.
Phaser 1 has like a tiny little bit sensitivity up in the left, like it's not really. Oh no, on this model actually. I think it might have a little bit. Yeah, I'm not sure why I didn't add it. Like there might be a little bit of sensitivity, but like it really doesn't beat LACB.
I see.
I remember okay. Well.
Yeah, just a heads up, we passed 2 p.m. So
yeah,
I say we give 5-10 minutes. Yeah,
it's okay. Only halfway through the talk. I will skip some stuff at the end. That's fine. Let me just wrap up this trigger stuff and then we call it a day. Okay, so this is what I was trying to tell Daniel, right? So CMS has actually done a scouting analysis, which is super nice. So what that means is that they reconstruct the muons at the trigger level already, but they don't have bandwidth to write out the whole event. So what they're doing is they're writing out only the four vectors of the muons plus some isolation information. So the rest of the event they throw out. But then once you write out those four vectors, you can actually reconstruct the invariant mass. They also write out the coordinates of the vertex, right, as you see here. And so these are invariant mass plots of the muons as a function of the lifetime bin that they're in. So this is the blue one is the prompt, basically the prompt region. And then orange is a little bit more displaced. And the more and more displaced you go, the more and more this background basically drops. And this is just all from measurement, right? So this is just the full, this is the full sandwich is all there is. And then what you can do, you can take this background, you can do a bump hunt on it. So you see here, where this is a JSI, this is the K short, this is the ETA and so on. This is actually K short going to pi plus pi minus, where the pi plus and pi minus are misidentified as muons, which occasionally happens at a very low rate, of course, but it does happen. And so what you can do is what they did, of course, you can do a bump hunt on this sort of thing and you can try to, you can set some sort of limit. In this case, for a fixed lifetime. They haven't recosted it yet in terms of this model, but I think they will do that very soon. So we're not really completely in the dark. I mean, they already have information on what they should expect. The advantage of doing it with a trigger, of course, is that you can write out a whole event. And if you were to see an excess of some sort, you have much more handles to characterize what it actually was that you saw. Okay. So now there are a number of other applications. Once you are able to trigger on displaced tracks, you can maybe look for a displaced vertex with some missing energy, or maybe you look for a vertex with many tracks, vertices, and you forget about muons. And so I'm just going to briefly tell you about this case over here, which I worked out with Yuri and Diego last year. And so the idea is somewhat similar. But now instead of muons, we're going to ask for four tracks instead of two. We're going to ask for a good quality vertex, and we're going to ask for some distance from the interaction point, again, to beat down backgrounds from B mesons. I should say before I proceed that this is more speculative than the muons. It's experimentally much more challenging in the sense that the combinatorics of reconstructing this vertex online is not demonstrated that this is possible. But so what we're trying to do here is to show that if it's possible, what kind of physics case you could get, so to motivate someone to actually try to see if they can devise an algorithm that's fast enough. So with that caveat in mind, so the backgrounds are fake backgrounds are very easily rejected now because the probability of four fake tracks randomly intersecting is very small. And so these we can suppress easily. B-meson backgrounds, we just cut out by this cut on the displacement. But there's a new background now, which is very challenging, which are material interactions. And this is what this plot is that maybe some of you have already seen. So if Atlas reconstructs every displaced vertex that they see from two tracks, you're seeing this, what's basically a PET scan. And these are pions, photons, other things that hit some layer in the detector, created secondaries, and those secondaries are reconstructed. So what you normally do is you basically blank out the regions of highest intensity because you know there's material there and you're trying to look for a new vertex in the signal in the white region, a relatively white region. This doesn't work very well at a trigger level because the track reconstruction is quite rudimentary. We don't have the inner layers. So our resolution on the vertex location is not so good. So you might be concerned that you know, this will just completely swamp you. Specifically, the number to keep in mind, about, oh, no, I forgot the exact, I knew at some point the number of, oh yeah, okay, I remember now. Every, about 5% of all the pions, the pi plus particles at the LHC that are created will create a displaced vertex by hitting some material in the tracker. So this is absolutely massive, right? So this happens all the time. Every event is gonna have things like this. So you're not necessarily pleased. Now, that said, all of these vertices are only two tracks and the PT cuts are very, very mild. It's only like a 500 MeV or so. So the question is, what happens if you ask for four tracks and if you increase the PT cuts to like 2 GV, 3 GV or so on? Unfortunately, there's no public plots to read that off from. So what I did at that point was I built like a Geon, a pion gun in Geon. So you fire pi pluses at a slab of silicon in Geon, and you check how many tracks come out on the other side and what their PT is. And then this result is weighted against the number of interaction lengths in the phase two tracker of the LHC. So they have some, they have calculated how much material there will be, which is what these plots are over here in units of the radiation length. And so this is the efficiency factor for each track that you then find. So what this means is that if I have a 50 GeV pion coming in and it has eta equals zero, let's say, it has a 1% chance of creating four tracks with PT at least bigger than 2 GeV. And so this is this drop-off over here. So the difference in these heights over here as a function of eta is just due to the different material budget as a function of the detector angle. So in the forward region, you always have more material. So you're more likely to create these secondaries, why this efficiency is higher here at about a factor of 10 in the forward region. So now the next thing you do is you generate some massive Pythia sample, take pileup to be 200, and you just count all the stable hadrons that you find, like kaons, pions, protons, neutrons, the whole sandwich basically. And you fold that into this efficiency that I computed before with Geond. And then the resulting spectrum is what you're seeing over here in units of megahertz. And so what you're seeing is that I'm roughly in the sort of kilohertz regime once I put all these cuts. And it sort of barely works. I didn't have to, but it somehow it does. I've been conservative here in a few ways. So in this simulation, I've assumed that every displaced track from a displaced vertex made in a material interaction is reconstructed 100% of the time, which is very conservative because very frequently they won't have the right angles, they will be misreconstructed and so on. No material veto was attempted, and we also didn't try to use isolation to beat this down any further. So this is the rate for the various backgrounds given the cuts that we have. So for 2 GeV PT cuts, the rate is sort of on the high end, but it's probably still manageable, about 25 kilohertz. But it drops very rapidly once you increase the PT cut on these particles, just because you ask four of them in each vertex. And then the rate for B-mesons and fakes are very much under control.
And what about secondaries from photons? That's not included there, no?
Secondary from photons are incredibly rare to make four tracks. They will make by E plus E minus, they tend to not make four tracks, yeah.
And pi zero.
We did back of the envelope that, but I don't have the number off the top of my head. Yeah, sorry.
And for pi zeros, is that an issue?
Pi zeros are essentially photons, right? So they just decay promptly to photons.
When you get a 10 to the minus 4 or 5, I forget, double dalits decays. I guess that doesn't matter. Those will give you electrons. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, but all of this is included, right? Because like I'm just running Pythia, right? It knows these things. Right, it should know the branching ratio. So this is all. So I'm just adding up. Okay, I'm just counting all the hadrons for a given PT bin, or all the stable charged particles, basically, not just the hadrons. Of course, the electrons are also included. I should have said that. Yeah, and it doesn't matter where they came from, whether they came from meson decays or from Joule-Young or whatever. And so then this is sort of what something like this looks like. The RET is the existing atlas. So they have a trigger which relies on, sorry, now I should clarify what I'm doing. I'm looking at Higgs decaying to two long-lived particles, S, which then decay with a displaced vertex to, you know, a jet, basically a bunch of hadrons, right? And so for this benchmark, atlas has a dedicated trigger which relies on the muon chamber, which is this red curve over here. Well, our estimate of what a potential futuristic CMS trigger could do is this blue over here. Of course, these are apples and oranges in the sense that the red thing exists. The blue is, you know, some, you know, optimist, some estimate of what we hope they might be able to do. So they're not at the same footing in any way. But the point is that by using the tracker, of course, you're sensitive to much shorter lifetimes than if you have to rely on the muon chamber. And so there would be some parametric, some new parameter space that you could open that you can never hope to access if you only have access to muon chamber triggers. And then if you'd like, you can map that onto sort of one of the sort of classic simplified models. So this is just this simplified Higgs sector where you have a quartic coupling of HH dagger to S squared. And then you again mix with the Higgs in order to make this thing decay. And this is, we just fix this branching ratio to be something that's relatively allowed. And this is the number of events that you would record with this type of trigger. So it's not a limit, right? So we're not, you know, committing to setting a limit, but we estimate roughly the amount of events you would be able to record as a function of these parameters over here. And so you see there is some region where it's currently not covered where you might have millions of these, which is pretty nice. We did the same thing for an axion-like particle. And this is the last thing, and then I will wrap up, where you know, you're coupled to your GG tilde as usual. And so if you take F to be very, very high, like 10 to the 6, the lifetime of this thing actually just becomes long just because this parameter is very small. And because your gluon width, your gluon PDF is very, very large at low masses, you still have an appreciable, you have some cross-section for these things. Even though this coupling is extremely suppressing the rate. So for 10 to the 6, you see I have about 30 autobarns of cross-section given these various PT cuts and so on, which is very tiny, but it's still something. And this is the lifetime sort of estimate. Sort of the point is that 10 to the 6 is roughly chosen so that you get like centimeter style lifetimes. So we carry out the same thing. So these are the efficiency plots versus. So ours is the green, and then there's some earlier work by the Maryland group where they did a slightly different strategy where you have those over here where we think that the 30 GeV PT one is a bit optimistic. So there's no background estimate for that one, but we're sort of in the same ballpark, I suppose. And so this is the same plot as a function of the decay constant versus mass, the amount of events you reconstruct. And so here you see this is pretty marginal. And on its own, this is probably not really worth it. If it wasn't for the Higgs channel that we just discussed, you're recording at most of the order of a couple tens of events at the high Lumi LHC. So I'd say that this is relatively disappointing and probably not. This is probably not a compelling but this is not going to really significantly alter the reach for this model. But since we had the simulation, it was worth checking. Okay, so that's it. So we're working on a scouting analysis for looking for these axion-like particles in the diphoton channel. But since I'm out of time, I will just wrap that up. So yeah, basically the point is that the LHC is a very nice Higgs and B factory. And I think they're really golden opportunities to look for new physics. And the reason is that they're very, very narrow. So you can, for relatively small couplings of like 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4, you can still have reasonable branching ratios of these particles to new states. And of course, for the Higgs, there is additional motivation that it's a singlet, so lots of things like to couple to it. Lots of BSM models which like to induce exotic Higgs decays. And so what's exciting is that in this front, there are new trigger strategies happening, being defined all the time by experimentalists. And I think it's important for us curious to like weigh in and try to like give them some guidance about which of these we're most excited about and why, so that they can prioritize their resources accordingly. All right, so that's it.
All right, thank you very much. Some virtual applause. Are there any more questions? I mean, if not, I'm just curious, why is the axion case so much worse than the scalar one?
Oh, yeah. So I went very, very fast. Can I go back or is that not? It doesn't let me go back somehow. Wait, now it does. Okay, good. Right. So first, let me talk about the scalar case. So that this is the model that we have in mind here, right? Mm. So you're referring to the case with the hadronic vertex, right? Or with the muons?
Well, what are you using for the axions? Is it muons or hadrons?
Hadrons.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so if I compare this one with the axion, right? The reason is here, you notice I have two coupling constants. I have this one and I have this one. This one preserves the Z2, so it's not going to contribute to the decay. But it does induce the exotic Higgs decay. So this one sets the cross-section.
Oh, you're decoupling production from decay in the scalar case.
Right, the
case,
production and decay are decoupled in this case, right?
I see.
Sort of when you're looking for long-lived particles anywhere, this is almost always the case, except the one exception is the model that we talked about in the beginning, where you have the parametric suppression of the muon Yukawa versus the top Yukawa production versus decay. But sort of generically, in anything at the LHC, if you're looking for a long-lived particle, you tend to have a different production mode from a decay mode. Like for instance, RPV SUSY, you produce with colored production, and then maybe the decay is long-lived because there's some RPV parameter that's very small, and so on. Well, here, you know, there's only one. This is why this model was attractive and why we wanted to try it, right? Because it's very predictive. There's just a mass and one coupling instead of two couplings. So it's kind of very minimal in that sense. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to live with the fact that a gluon PDF is really, really huge, so you can get away with a tiny, tiny coupling. Unfortunately, numerically, it works out to, you know, you do the back of the envelope and you find like, a 1,000 events or something, or like, 500, 600, something like that, the simulation, and you put in more and more factors, like it keeps shrinking, and eventually you end up at 30, and you're like, okay, that's kind of not really great. But, you know, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Now that makes sense.
Yeah, that's the reason, yes, because this model is more constrained on the model side. If I have some other mechanism that produces these guys, right, maybe they come from like Higgs decay, which is basically the previous model, or there are some other exotic states that make these, then of course everything's back and you're back in business.
Yeah. Any more questions?
Ask you about the case which has missing energy in the end, in the final state?
How
does that work?
You mean this one over here?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something that we have been looking into with some folks in Brussels. It's potentially useful for inelastic dark matter and heavy neutral leptons. Now, so what you're hoping to do here is to trigger on the soft tracks and displacement, like maybe a displaced muon, and lower the MET PT, basically, right? Just saying, okay, like maybe I only need 100 GeV of MET rather than, 50 GeV rather than 100 GeV. Now, what we keep finding, I'm not excluding that this is possible, but what we keep finding is, especially for inelastic dark matter, which is the benchmark that we're looking at first, is that the PT of these guys is very correlated with the MET distribution. And so you basically always find yourself in a situation that you're not gaining very much by splitting, by lowering the MET cut and requiring a PT on this one, because your rate, they're too correlated in some ways. Mm-hmm. So, you'll get some gain, at least from what we've seen so far. It doesn't work as well as I was hoping it would.
Yeah. How do you do like the trigger? Do you like relax how close this vertex is from, like goes back to the interaction point?
Right. So in this case, we cannot rely on pointing, right? Yeah. Because like there's this MET, right? So we relax on exactly. pointing, and we would try to compensate for that loss in, you know, for that increase in background by requiring some amount of missing energy. But it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't look like it works as well as I was hoping. And so we haven't ruled out that it will work in some ways. Maybe we need some more clever thinking. But
is
at
it
this
possible
point,
to yeah. Is it possible yeah. to require that the additional thing like adds up to point you back to the interaction point? Or that's not something?
Well, if you require this to be muons and you point back to the interaction point, you're basically back in the previous scenario, right?
Oh, no. I mean, like with the thing that you don't see, you hypothetically add something which help you like go back, and if that matches with the amount of MET you have, does it help?
Oh, you mean say you're taking the MET and you're making sure that the MET points with the yeah. We haven't done that. I'm a little bit concerned that the pointing resolution of the MET may not be good enough, especially at the trigger level, because there's lots of things that you're missing out of. When you're doing at the trigger, right? So my intuition is that the angular resolution on the MET is likely insufficient for that. But we haven't tried. I need to think how to even do that properly.
That sounds interesting. But wouldn't you usually produce pairs of these, and then you have two missing particles?
It depends. Not in these two specific models that I wrote down over here. The inelastic dark matter tends to be you produce a chi-1, chi-2 particle.
And oh, yeah, in that case, yeah.
The chi-1 plus some crap, and then you're trying to find the crap. But you can write down a model where you pair produce them, but in this specific simple thing that we were toying with, it doesn't, it's not the case.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know that this will work. I don't know that this part that we will end up being able to write a paper. We'll see. We're still toying with it, but it's not close to being done.
But actually, in both cases, right? Even if you produce chi1, chi2 decays back to chi1, so you always end up with two chi1s in the final state.
Right, right.
And in the heavy neutrino case, yeah. It's again the same story.
Right. Actually, this is another reason why the pointing with the MET won't work, right? Because there are two particles contributing to the MET, and you can't disentangle them.
Yeah.
So regardless of the resolution, for this specific model, this would not work. For the heavy neutral leptons, maybe. I haven't actually looked at that. My intuition is that the missing energy for those is also going to be small. So the thing to understand is that unless you cut relatively hard on MET, you're not winning much, because essentially every event at the LHC, especially at the high limit of the LHC, has 30-40 GV of MET, just from mismeasurement of jets and all sorts of things. So unless you cut at least at 50 GV MET, you're not really reducing the rate. And once I cut 50 GV of MET, now my muons are also at 20 GV or something like that, right? Yeah. And so I already paid a pretty big penalty on the rate at that point, just because these two variables are very correlated in these models. Yeah. That seems to be the bottleneck so far.
But in the heavy neutrino case,
the best way to look for this is to actually just look for the muons and forget about the net. That's why. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Thanks.
Yeah, just that in the heavy neutrino case, if you're producing only one, so that in the end you decay back to a single final state neutrino, you usually use charge current channel. And if that's open to you, then you might as well also look for the charge current decay where you can fully reconstruct the N. I mean, it's not immediately obvious that we're gaining anything.
Right. So you're saying you look for you fully reconstruct.
Because I'm thinking one nice thing that you could do is models where you have some production by some new force. So like Be My The Self, for example, is something that people look at. So in that case, usually you produce the neutrinos in pairs, the heavy right. neutrinos in pairs. And then you fall back into basically the inelastic dark matter case.
Yes. Right.
But if you're in the minimal model, then you have charge current available and may not be so advantageous.
Yeah, so what you're looking at a fully hadronic decay then, or what do you have in mind?
Yeah, you could do mu pi, depending on the mass of this thing, of course. But you'd see muon pion or muon kaon, things like that, depending on the mixings and so on.
This is very difficult at the trigger level, right? So you don't have, you cannot try to trigger on a kaon and a muon, for instance, because the rate is just really high. Like it's just not feasible. The standard model background for that sort of thing is too high, I think. So you really need either two muons plus pointing plus vertexing. Or if you take one of these three requirements away, you have to replace it with something else that's sufficiently powerful. And a kaon, I don't think is going to cut it because there's like tons of kaons in every event, right? And so we don't have kaon identification either, right? We don't know the difference between kaons and pions and electrons and so on.
Interesting.
So of course, at LHCb, you know, it's a different story because LHCb can reconstruct their entire detector online. There you could do what you say, and I would probably do pretty well. And maybe that's a very interesting thing to try. But I don't think that that's in the cards yet for Atlas and CMS.
It might be interesting to look at
N
to neutrino mu mu. That maybe that's still a competitive search then. Interesting.
So, yes, right. So the problem always with LHCb is that their sensitivity drops very fast once the lifetime increases. Just because their detector is really optimized for millimeter lifetimes, and they because they're not hermetic, right? So not even in the forward region, the velo is discs, so things go out from the sides all the time, and it becomes a problem.
Okay, any more questions for Simon? Well, I think we had a lot of discussion, 1 hour and a half we've been here. So thanks again, Simon.
Yeah, thanks, this was fun.